Hello and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio. I'm Keith Parent. Coming up on today's program, North Korea made an announcement this week that the country's top military advisor to Kim Jong-un has stepped down for health reasons. TEPCO, the Japanese company, is to release tapes of the Fukushima nuclear power disaster, but some people remain skeptical whether or not this will show what truly happened. Two Hong Kong billionaire brothers have been released on bail after being charged with bribing government officials. We have this and much more on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. In a three-line statement, the North Korean media has announced the removal of General Ri Yong-ho from all of his posts because of illness. General Ri is a close confidant of the new president, Kim Jong-un, and was a very important military figure in the power transition following the death of Kim Jong-il. His removal raises questions whether or not North Korea is in the throes of political upheaval. We have this story from Kandahar Sapati.
The sudden and quick announcement by the North Korean Politburo that it was relieving General Ri Yong-ho from all his posts on health grounds has left many astounded and surprised, including the South Koreans. This is Kim Hyung-suk, the spokesman for the South Korean Unification Ministry.
There was an internal meeting within North Korea yesterday on July the 15th. We believe it is very unusual for North Korea to quickly and openly report the meeting results early this morning.
The smooth transition of power to Kim Jong-un after his father's death last December was made possible because of the close nurturing by a three-party regency, including General Ri and the president's aunt and uncle. In just over 6 months, the young, inexperienced Kim Jong-un has assumed all the top posts. So the sudden removal of General Ri raises the question if this is a power struggle or a generational change. Professor John Mackay, a partner with Analysis International in Melbourne, explains.
This is not the first of the old guard, if we can call them that, who've been dismissed. The head of the secret police, Woo Dong-chuk, was replaced recently with a younger person, someone who's supposedly very close to Kim Jong-un. There have been suggestions that this may not be a power struggle so much as a generational change.
It was only in October 2010 that Kim Jong-un was introduced as the heir apparent to his father, Kim Jong-il. Using his multiple roles, both in the ruling Workers' Party and as chief of staff in the military, General Ri has helped the young and inexperienced President Kim to take control of the regime in Pyongyang. This, some say, has led to many within the party and the military to feel threatened by the growing influence of General Ri over the president and thus his removal. There also could be another reason, says Professor John Mackay.
There's also a suggestion that the military may be upset because Kim Jong-un has stressed that he would like to give much more attention to the health of the economy, and that might involve moving some resources away from the military into building a stronger economy. North Korea has had for a number of years a so-called military first policy, which stresses that national security and the support of the armed services comes way above any other of the nation's aims and priorities. If, as is rumoured, Kim Jong-un would like to change that a little, it's likely that he will meet some resistance in the military.
Since coming into power, Kim Jong-un has been changing the style of leadership. He is moving away from the more staid political style of his father to the warm populist presence of his grandfather, Kim Il-sung. Unlike his father, Kim Jong-un is more tactile, has been seen in the company of a young woman, and is beginning to build around him a group of young and capable leaders, says Professor Mackay.
There is a new political officer in the military, Choi Ryong-hae, who is seen as one of Kim Jong-un's favourites and maybe in line for a very rapid promotion. The head of the secret police has been replaced by a younger person, again, supposedly a closer confidant of Kim Jong-un. So there are young people coming through, seen as being able to take charge of a very different kind of regime.
Even if this is true, Does the sudden removal of General Ri indicate that Kim Jong-un is confident of controlling and directing all the political forces, including the military? Professor Mackay.
It's either Kim Jong-un is much more sure of himself and his leadership than we had believed, or there is the beginnings of a power struggle going on. I guess we won't know the answer to that for some weeks or months.
Two billionaire brothers have been released on bail after being charged with bribing Hong Kong's former number two government official. Thomas and Raymond Kwok are co-chairmen of Sun Hung Kai Properties, the world's second largest property developer. 4 months after their first arrest, they've been accused of paying the official, Raphael Hui, more than $4.5 million for information on land sales between 2000 and 2009. The Kwok brothers were charged just a day after Hong Kong's development minister, Mei Chai Kwong, was arrested with three others on suspicion of corruption linked to government housing allowances. Richard Irwat speaks to Emily Lau, the vice chair of the Democratic Party in Hong Kong.
It's really a very, very big sensational news in Hong Kong, not only because it involves one of the biggest property developers here, but also it involved a very, very senior former government official. And I think many Hong Kong people are still in some sort of state of shock because we have always prided ourselves that this city is politically relatively clean and not that corrupt. But of course, people are very thankful that we have the Independent Commission Against Corruption, the ICAC, and which we hope will continue to be fearless and independent and will go against anyone, no matter how senior or rich, if they breach the law.
But if the charges against the Kwok brothers and against the former government official Raphael Hui are proved, I mean, what this will show is that there's been collusion between the high end of the property market and at least one government official, and I suppose the fear is there may be more people involved.
Well, sadly, that is one thing that many people, including my party, the Democratic Party, have always suspected, and that is collusion between the government, i.e. the senior government officials, and the business sector, particularly the real estate sector. And that's why some of our major policies are always inclined to favor the big developers. That's something that people have talked about for decades. And now there seem to be concrete evidence emerging. And it's not only confined to the Hong Kong government. In the past, when senior leaders from Beijing come to visit Hong Kong, some of them would always have breakfast with Mr. Li Ka-shing and his sons and would stay in his hotel. I mean, this is really conduct unbecoming of a country's leader. But that has happened for many years. And also, the Beijing leaders used to have a habit of inviting a handful, maybe 10 or so, of the richest people, and of course most of them are real estate property developers, to either go to Beijing or to Shenzhen to consult them. So you can see this pattern that's been going on for decades. And many people, of course, find this very, very reprehensible.
Does that mean, therefore, that the point you raised about the reputation that Hong Kong has for transparency and for being a clean nation runs the risk now of being tarnished, but on the other hand, maybe what it takes in order to clean things up for good and all?
Exactly. Well, the reputation definitely has been tarnished, and there is the former chief executive, Mr. Donald Zhang, has also been accused of being greedy and corrupt. And then the current chief executive, Mr. C.Y. Leung, has also been accused of lacking in integrity. So there are many problems. But it's good that certain rich and powerful people are being prosecuted, and we will see how this case pans out. I hope it has fired a warning shot to all those people who keep on intending to be corrupt.
In the case of the new chief executive, Siu Ai Lung, I mean, he's talking about adopting tighter conflict of interest regulations, but bearing in mind he's also under scrutiny himself over illegal structures at his luxury apartment, he's somewhat conflicted, isn't he? People are going to be a bit suspicious.
Well, people are very suspicious of Siu Ai Lung and his administration, and that makes the atmosphere here extremely volatile. And some commentaries in the papers are saying that he's only been given 100 days to prove himself. And of course, the pro-Beijing politicians all deny this. But it seems that if he cannot salvage his own reputation and prove that he can govern Hong Kong, he may have to go very soon.
That was Emily Lau, the vice chair of the Democratic Party in Hong Kong, speaking with Richard Ehrwart. The operator of the Fukushima nuclear power plant in Japan, TEPCO, has bowed to pressure and will release hours of teleconference video taken in the days after last year's meltdowns. But the company has confirmed that audio of an angry exchange with the then Prime Minister Nato Khan is missing. TEPCO says its hard drive was full. But in an exclusive interview with ABC in Australia, Mr. Khan says he believes TEPCO has resisted releasing the tapes because the company is trying to hide something. And he says the fact that the audio of his speech is missing, in his own words, is strange. Mark Willacy has more.
It's a window into the decisions, dramas and dangers at the heart of the world's worst nuclear crisis since Chernobyl. A database of hundreds of hours of teleconference discussions between TEPCO's top officials and its managers at the shattered Fukushima plant. But for months, TEPCO has resisted pressure to release the recordings, arguing it's in-house material, and to release it would compromise the privacy of those on the tapes. That's rubbish, according to the man who was the Prime Minister of Japan when the country faced its biggest disaster since World War II. In an exclusive interview with the ABC, Nato Khan argues the TEPCO tapes must be released. This is extremely important material which is needed to investigate the cause of this accident, the former Prime Minister tells me. It's like the black box flight recorder on an aeroplane. The black box is crucial to understanding how an accident happened. So too are these recordings, says Nato Khan. After months of pressure from Mr. Khan and the government, TEPCO now says it'll release the teleconference recordings. Hiroyuki Kawai is a lawyer who's been fighting for the release of the TEPCO tapes. He believes they'll help solve some abiding mysteries at the heart of the disaster. TEPCO executives purposely delayed pumping seawater into the damaged reactors, Mr. Kawai tells me. The tapes will prove they did this because they knew pumping in salt water would force them to decommission the reactors, he says. Another mystery the recordings could help solve is who is telling the truth about TEPCO's early handling of the crisis, specifically whether the company wanted to withdraw its workers from the crippled plant, as the then Prime Minister Nato Khan has alleged. The most contentious issue is whether or not TEPCO was planning to abandon the Fukushima plant, says Mr. Khan. The audio and video will make it clear what discussions TEPCO was having about withdrawing, he tells me. The recordings may also clear up persistent questions about Mr. Khan's handling of the crisis, specifically allegations he meddled at key moments, effectively delaying TEPCO's response to the disaster. But on that score, it appears one crucial recording involving Nato Khan is missing, with TEPCO confirming to the ABC that an address the then Prime Minister gave at the very beginning of the crisis to 200 executives, including the company president, has no audio. TEPCO says that's because its hard drive was full. I think this is extremely strange, Nato Khan says. The speech was filmed and broadcast to all TEPCO sites. Surely they recorded the sound at one of those sites. It would appear the company is trying to hide something inconvenient, Mr. Khan tells me. TEPCO now has to decide when to release the teleconference recordings and how it will release them. Lawyer Hiroyuki Kawai believes the release of the so-called TEPCO tapes is crucial if Japan is to both understand the cause of the nuclear meltdowns and to learn from them. The Fukushima nuclear accident is ongoing. It's not been resolved yet, Mr. Kawai says. The TEPCO recordings are a common asset of the Japanese people, and not for a private company like TEPCO to hide, he says. Hiding has long been a hallmark of Japan's nuclear industry. But the release of these recordings may be a sign that it can no longer thumb its nose at governments or the public will.
You're listening to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio. If you'd like to contact us, our email address is pcj@pcjmedia.com. Computer scientists at Hong Kong University say they have developed a software to track censored posts on Sina Weibo, China's largest microblogging site. Lead researcher Dr. Qinghua Fu says users have ways to get around censorship and still talk about sensitive issues. He speaks next to Scott Albany of Radio Deutsche Welle.
One part of my study is to look at the content of what they post online. So we make use of some computer programming to download the data from the Sina Weibo, the timeline. We are tracking around 300,000 users with a large number of fans count, more than 1,000 followers, and to follow up this group of people every day and look at their timeline. That means look at what they post.
But you're also tracking the censored posts, as I understand
My primary purpose is to look at the content of what they post. Okay, so that's why we develop a system, we a group of people, download their posts regularly and save in our server.
But that would also contain controversial stuff or things
I want to explain to you. Because from time to time, we find out some missing posts. That means now there's a post, but after a while, some disappear. So we start to investigate why. Why some posts disappear from the timeline. So there are a number of different reasons. First, maybe the user voluntarily deleted. That's possible, right? But we found out a lot of them, actually, they're filtered by the company or by the authorities. So we can, using computer programs, distinguish these two kinds of deleted posts. So,
the authorities in Beijing, but that's also affecting users in Hong Kong?
No. It's basically most of the posts we filter is filtered by the company. By the Sina Weibo,
right.
Because they are looking at the content and using different techniques to try to comply with the legal requirement in China. That's why they do it internally.
So it's in a sense, self-censorship. Sina Weibo is a Chinese version of microblogging sites that we know, such as Twitter and Facebook, that sort of thing. How many people use Sina Weibo?
Now, a registered account, so more than 300 million.
300 million users. That's quite...
Account. I put it in an account, because one people can open more than one account.
And is there a function such as with Twitter, where accounts can be verified as being authentic?
Yeah. Now they have authentication now.
Some posts that you have determined or detected as having been removed, some apparently mentioned the former Communist Party boss in Chongqing, Bo Xilai, also the dissident Cheng Guacheng, who was recently moved to the United States. What does that tell you about the service and about how people feel they can use the service?
Actually, they are not really removed, but the people can't access it. They're using some filtering thing that you can't access some of the message in China. So even you post on your timeline, you can read it. But your friends or all the other people can't read your post.
Which kind of defeats the object, doesn't it, of microblogging?
Yeah.
If nobody else can read.
Propagate the thing that you can put. That means no one can read your message. And some part of it are those political sensitive issues. That's you might have Bo Xilai and also... Li Gongcheng, these kind of issues. If there's some keyword, but a lot of smart microblogging in China, they can make use of different kinds of words, a symbol, or something related to the topics, then they can create a lot of things. Even without the Bo Xilai, without Chen Gongcheng, they can also communicate the issue in China.
So they're getting around the issue.
Yeah, they're getting around. You try to bypass the keyword system.
Right.
But of course, this is a battle between both parties. But actually, even with such a limitation and restriction on the microblog space, they still can discuss about this issue. We found out a number of comments on Chen Guangchen, for example, about why a China citizen can't stay in China. They need to find the most safety place in America. So the people comment on or for this doesn't touch on the sensitive keyword. But people can express that opinion without this keyword. So within the first 2 and 3 hours after the publication, they didn't circulate and repost and retweet over 10 or 20 thousand times in China. A lot of people received the message and then repost again and circulate. A lot of people read it. But after 3 or 4 hours, some people tag, oh, that may touch on sensitive issue. Then people filter it. So even within 3 or 4 hours, information can be transmitted to a lot of people and sent to a lot of people can read this kind of message.
That was the lead researcher of computer sciences at Hong Kong University speaking with Scott Albany. A journalist in Thailand is accused of not having removed commentaries allegedly slandering the King of Thailand from her paper's internet forum in 2009. She could face up to 50 years in prison. Thai law prohibits any form of lis majesty, but since the crackdown in 2006, the government has increasingly used the rules to crack down on critical voices. Sarah Magwood has this special report.
Shiranut Premchaipon is a petite, cheerful woman. Her nickname, Diu, means tiny. She doesn't seem to be comfortable in the spotlight with her newfound role as a leader of the battle for press freedom. She would rather just go back to her work. Premchaipon is an online journalist for the independent online newspaper Prachatai. In 2008, unknown persons allegedly posted insulting remarks about the king in the user forum of that website, and now Chiranut Premchaipon is accused of not having removed them quickly enough. She faces the possibility of up to 50 years in prison.
They say that I intentionally left the comments of the Prachatai web board up longer than necessary. The law doesn't give any rules or regulations for what constitutes too long. Neither are there any practical examples, nor is there any existing jurisprudence.
The American activist CJ Hinkey is the founder of the NGO Freedom Against Censorship Thailand. He's been reporting every day about the hearing on his blog.
In Prachatai, the comments that were made on the website referred to the king as the blind father because he is nearly blind in one eye from a childhood auto accident. The queen was referred to as Mama Blue because, of course, she's the mother of the nation and her royal color is blue. Are these insulting?
Thailand has been a constitutional monarchy since 1932. The king is the most important authority in the entire country. Golden framed pictures of the monarch hang in every public space and even in private homes. Honouring him is the highest duty of every Thai citizen. The so-called Lese Majeste law states that anyone who defames, insults or threatens the king, the queen or their heirs will be sentenced to 15 years imprisonment. No concrete definitions of what constitutes an offence are provided. Shiranut Premchaipon is expected to receive her sentence on April 30th. Her case is highly symbolic and the first one dealing with third-party reliability. In future, people could even be sued for not keeping someone else from insulting the royal family. This would mean that posting a link to an article or liking something on Facebook that criticizes the king would be punishable by law. Benjamin Zawocki from Amnesty International explains that once you've been charged, the chances of being acquitted are slim.
Well, there's a particular provision in the law which allows anyone at all, to levy a lese majeste charge against anyone else. That charge is handed to the police hand the charge to the Office of the Prosecution, and anyone essentially then can be prosecuted for this law. And the conviction rate is well over 90%. And so essentially, once you are accused, it's virtually as if you are guilty until proven innocent.
The accused generally make a confession quickly, in the hope that they can at least get a pardon from the king. Human rights groups say that politicians abuse the law in order to increase their own power. Ever since the coup d'etat in 2006, the law has been used 16 times the rate than before, especially against the opposition and journalists. About 500 cases are taken to court every year. Sean Crispin of the New York non-profit organization Committee to Protect Journalists reads a clear message from the government.
What we've seen is the government, by targeting high-profile individuals with these effectively anti-royal charges, they're trying to send a message to all journalists that this is an area you're not allowed to go to. This is still taboo, and if you dare tread into this space, you run the risk of similar charges.
Reporters Without Borders view the Lèse Majesté law as a threat to freedom of the press. Strong censorship has been mainly limiting the freedom of opinion online since Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawat took office in June 2011. Reporters Without Borders maintain that the politicians are abusing the law. The new government has intensified internet surveillance. Over 600,000 websites are currently blocked, most because of the suspicion of insulting the monarchy. Nearly 700 more are being blocked on a daily basis. A public debate about changing the law wasn't possible for many years. No politician would have dared to bring up the topic. The danger of being reported to the police would have been too great. But despite this problem, critical voices have been growing for about 2 years. Independent groups organise protests, hunger strikes and marches on a regular basis in order to increase pressure on the government. Members of the so-called Red Shirts have been giving a lot of support to these groups. They too have been calling for a reform of the Lèse Majesté law. The UN, the EU, some Thai celebrities and even 8 members of the royal family have been calling for clear reduction of sentences, among other things. Prichan is a 68-year-old member of the Red Shirts. He and other protesters are using unusually critical words these days.
The Monarchy is not the god. He is a simple man. So listen to us, talk with us, so we can both go together. But the Monarchy and the people surround will not accept this idea. They try to beat us. That's why they think that the people is only the tiny matter under their feet.
King Bhumibol did claim in a speech in 2005 that people should be allowed to criticise him. But that hasn't changed anything so far. Wrestling over the highly sensitive law might become a long process despite the ever-increasing public pressure. Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawat has already announced that she will not permit any changes to the law so as not to appear disloyal to the king. A parliamentary committee is currently working on this issue.
And with that report from Sarah Magwood, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio. So on behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell wishing you well. We'll see you again in 7 days' time. Bye-bye, everyone.